in today's times where there is such a growth and deepened interest in spirituality, perhaps because the world is said to be in a, as the title says, chaotic and full of suffering. Chaos has always been there, suffering has always been there. Are we in a much more chaotic and a much more difficult world? That's an open topic for people to discuss and argue with. But general approach to it is, it has always been chaotic. There's always been suffering wherever there has been sentient beings. And therefore, in today's times, just as in the past, but even more so, an interest in spirituality has definitely happened. An interest, especially in Buddha Dharma, has happened, which I think is wonderful. It's very, very nice. Buddhist teachers and teachings' perspective on this is nothing exciting. If people say, oh, this is a very exciting place where Dharma is spreading and growing, to keep up with the conversation, we may say, yes, it's very exciting. But on the other hand, if you look at it, it's the most normal thing that should happen. Didn't happen earlier, that's an object of curiosity. Because Buddhism has never claimed and should never be seen as adoption of a newer thing to do. It never is. You'll get into trouble, as many of us have gotten into trouble, when you try to see Dharma and your engagement with the Buddhist teachings as a new thing to do. That is what will bring spiritual materialism into even this part of the practice, which never claims to be this or that, simply says, discover the truth as it is. And in discovering the truth, the ultimate view has to be not even a Buddhist. Anyone who claims the Buddhists have the copyright over absolute truth, just can't happen. That's just another mask, another dress, another new pair of clothing that you would put on your own self. Is not really understanding the actual essence and the meaning of what Buddhism is. True Buddhism is about delving into the human potential, whoever you are, for the simple fact that every human being endowed with exceptional qualities, particularly of an intelligent mind that can discern and see things that are a cause of happiness and see things that are a cause of unhappiness, and together with that have the absolute power to engage in relevant actions that can remove, do away with those causes that are unwanted, that are seemingly causes of unhappiness and confusion for oneself and the others. Also, one is endowed with an absolute awareness, sanity, and intelligence, and the power to engage in those actions where your own right mind tells you what are the causes that should be cultivated, should be strengthened, and becomes a cause of happiness for oneself and the others. Where human life is endowed with this exceptional quality, Buddhist teachings question, why is that not awakened within one's own self? Why does a sensible person with who is endowed with all these qualities doesn't wake up to that fact? And so the growth of Dharma from that perspective would be growth of basic awareness of human potential, that you would not be living in a state of confusion and mistaken perceptions, that blame is not always being put into the most convenient places, but that the individual has better insight, better wisdom capability to introspect and see that potential within one's own self, and realizing that also has the courage to then be responsible for that potential. That is then living life as a human being should. Now, temporarily, if we are going to call that a Buddhist practitioner, then one can do so. But the view of the Dharma, view of the Buddhist teachings is that. Now, when that is not understood, since today the topic Mahayana and the motivation of Mahayana, and particularly pertaining to the view, as you have told me, then sadly that then I think is not so much happening. physical bodies, in terms of membership in communities that are practicing together, that's there. Increase in profound philosophical rhetorics about emptiness and goodness and compassion, that's in abundance. Sitting on the cushion and having all the paraphernalia of spirituality, that's, you know, there's a good business market in that. But that is today, and it's not very new, 40, 50 years of Western Buddhism, 2,500 years of Buddhism, and 1,200 years of Tibetan Buddhism, should have done or contributed significantly to some change. Sometimes I think about it that way. Nowhere in the world has anyone written, said, spoken, or held the philosophy of compassion more than Buddhists. Isn't it? Each one of you, if you have been in Buddhism for more than 5 years, will by now have a fair amount of collection on books, each titled Compassion This Way, Compassion That Way, 10 Steps to Compassion, Quick Compassion, Slow Compassion, Classical Compassion, Modernized Compassion. Isn't it? Does, however, now, of course, there are many people who've done marvelously well in having inculcated those teachings. But if realistically looking at the situation, then as much as commodity on compassion is out there, required fruition evident amongst those who hold that philosophy of compassion, that's a little bit not there. Last year, I shouldn't have said last year. Anyway, last year, during one of the great gatherings where His Holiness the Dalai Lama was present, speaking about global compassion, there was a whole stadium of, I think, about 15 or 16,000 people mesmerized by the message of compassion. Everyone very inspired by His Holiness's presence and teachings. Then, up there in the VIP section were people like ourselves, monks and nuns, long-term practitioners, many great titles, holinesses and eminences and venerables and reverends and so on and so forth. And since we were in charge of ushering people, the kind of direct experience that we had was very surprising. 5 people turned up late in that section with tickets of seats upon which were 5 big practitioners, just to keep it a little bit abstract and anonymous. And so these nuns sitting on my left here were all responsible for trying to have them move one row behind so that those who actually held the tickets could sit on their proper seats. While the whole group was angry at them for turning up late or coming late, these 5 great practitioners, they're teaching actually these days, refused to get up. First come, first serve. It didn't matter. It was one row. It wouldn't have made any difference. But this is an example that is not once in an event. Any one of you who've lived within spiritual communities will have experienced, one way or the other, expressions of these attitudes and conducts. Now, in this case, what are we doing? Why are we writing books? Why do we claim to be meditators? Why do we go and become a member of a certain community in search of that elusive thing called enlightenment, whatever it means? No one, neither the speaker, nor the doer, nor those who organize it, have any idea what it is. Nevertheless, we're all going to be together. And not only that, we're going to tell the rest of the world we're better than them. And the sad aspect of this story is no one can actually argue with us. We'll always win the argument because we have this great profound philosophy called Buddha Dharma on our side. We have great masters to take as examples. We have lineages to propound about. We have great logic and rhetorics to display. and we can wiggle our way out of any difficult situation. But that skill does very little to transcend and transform that human mind. It remains the same. We constantly take on newer things. We wear newer masks. We put better sets of clothing. And those become more and more complex, more and more elaborate. But if the inner mind doesn't change, then, for one, why are we doing this? That itself becomes a big question. And number two, who is the one most at a disadvantage? No one but yourself. Who gets fooled the best? No one but oneself. The rest of the world will find their way this way or that. But oneself falling into that abyss, falling into that kind of a sort of a fabricated illusion that we create, unfortunately suffers the most. And this is sad, because it's about having come so far, which itself is a great difficult situation. To have found your way to understanding the Dharma is difficult. To have, as we say in Buddhism, have actually obtained a human life, that's very difficult. In that, having become a human being, in that being living as a human being, having all the possibilities of positive situations that has made your mind come to an awareness of its deeper potential, that's very difficult. Think of the countless millions of beings who may have the same aspirations and wishes, but at the same time, doesn't come to a ripened moment where they take that responsibility in one's own self. That's extremely difficult. That insight, that profound and deepened ability to look within, to come up with that question that inspires you on a path of the teachings, such as that of Buddha Dharma or any spirituality, is an extremely difficult and a rare moment, rare opportunity. But bringing all of those hundreds of positive circumstances, rare and difficult to come by, brought into a fruitioning of that moment, and then it encounters that one inability, takes the same attitude into a newer philosophy. And that attitude being is seeing more the practice and the method and the appearance as being essential, more essential than the genuine transformation and the change that needs to come within one's own self, which is a very difficult thing and probably the only most important factor that triggers the actual fruition, the actual result of every effort that you put into meditation and learning of any spirituality. So that's why I always say, whether we like it or not, as I said in the beginning, Buddhism is growing and expanding. But in comparison to other philosophies and religion, Buddhism hasn't ever become popular and will never become popular. Buddhism just cannot be popular. No matter how many ways, and there are lots of today people who say, we need to learn better marketing strategies. How we can really do this. Yeah, there are outreach program. I recently was looking into a jazz festival to promote Buddhism. You know. So anyway, so these are all very good intentions. I don't know how successful they are or how really necessary they are. But the fact of the matter is, Buddhism will never, no matter what we do, ever become more popular than what we are doing at the moment. Even among Buddhists, Buddhism will never become popular. Why so is because ultimately you begin to realize Buddhism is about working with yourself. And that's not what we bargained for. When you became a Buddhist, very rarely does a person wholeheartedly know that you are the subject of change, that you are going to be the guinea pig that has to go through the experiments, and all the changes that have to occur within. There is no way you can actually gain much from Dharma. Now, of course, having said that, as always, let me one point I need to stress is, in comparison to not doing any Buddhism, then this fabricated masking clothing kind of a Buddhism is also very good. For those of you who then will say, then I don't need to do, or I can't do, then by all means. I've always taken the example of my own grandmother, my late grandmother. My grandmother grew up in a family surrounded by excellent teachers. My own father, head of the lineage of the Nyingmapas, should have been able to convince her that she had to change and work with her own mind in order to be able to truly have some understanding and realization. She spent her whole life absolutely disbelieving her son-in-law. She was of the firm belief that if she recited a certain number of mantras every night, that after her death she was going to be immediately born into the Pure Land Sukhavati. That was her thing. And when I grew up, I tried to champion my father by trying to tell her, you know, you should work with training your mind. She told me she was much older than me, more experienced in life, and I should keep quiet. She never, to the time of her death, she never ever wished to discuss the concept of emptiness, concept of mind, looking at what the nature of mind might be. Her firm belief was, Amitabha was getting her apartment ready somewhere in the Buddha fields, and that was what she was very happy about. Now, I have always in my life taken my grandmother, late grandmother, as an example when I want to talk about this point. Today, several years after her death, what I do find is I need to take my word back in many of these situations, because as a person, she lived her life, theistic and orthodox, conservative as she might be, much better than a lot of us who know a lot of about emptiness and training the mind, but never got down to doing it. So in saying this, sometimes a contrived approach to an orthodox blind faith is actually very good. Now, however, that then you have to also say, I am orthodox. My grandmother always said that. I am orthodox. I am someone with blind faith. And therefore, in one's own mind, there has to be the honest approach. Yes, I would like to believe in this. This is what I can do. This is the capacity that I have. And I'm not going to pretend to be otherwise. The problem is that most of us don't even have that much of a courage to claim that. So somewhere, we all have an idea of a paradise. We call it enlightenment. But sometimes in our mind, it's not very different from the concept of heaven, from the concept of a new location, an easy zone where there is sort of no problems, no confusion, no difficulties. So therefore, when that contrivance comes into one's own mind and you do not really examine that, your relationship to the path of the practice becomes very confusing. The confusion comes is where outwardly you're talking and trying to cultivate a path of practice that deals with letting go of a lot of false beliefs. And on the other hand, there's also a simultaneous weakness within one's own self, a lack of courage within one's own self, that's unwilling to actually believe whatever it is that you're proclaiming to believe. And so here we are, what is called lack of view. And so where view is the most fundamental, knowing the view of the Dharma is the most fundamental teaching practice that must be cultivated in the mind of a meditator. There are many of us who have a vague idea of the view, but have begun to concentrate more on the methods that are intertwined with the view. And it's very, very unfortunate. But over time, it has become, we fall back into the human pattern of being so much more attached to the methods and the practices than to actually have the clarity within one's own self to cultivate the view, the actual view, within our own mind. And so for people, for example, let's see, those of us who become monks and nuns, we wear the robes, we shave our hair. And so there's a lot of talk, oh, your hair is much longer, you need to shave today. Or this is the way to do things, or that is the way to do things. And we're very dutiful to that. But then we may be unwilling to move one row behind. Yeah. So here is the indication of where you're more religious than able to understand the view of that religion, of that path of practice. Vegetarianism. It's all very wonderful to be vegetarian. But why are you a vegetarian? One in Buddhism becomes a vegetarian out of utter compassion as that of a mother for her child, and cannot tolerate the pain of the animal or any being. And therefore, the least that you can do and express your continued awareness of the suffering of other sentient beings is by not taking meat, let's say. Then, same vegetarian person sometimes says the most hurtful thing to the people sitting around the table. They're not sentient beings. Just because their heads are not chopped off, there's no blood splattered on the floor, doesn't mean it's a different kind of a suffering that doesn't have to be acknowledged. There's this subtle sort of, that's what I call subterfuge, that we allow the ego to work with. Fuller transformation, full alertness, full watchfulness of one's own attitude and conduct, we have great resistance to that. Since we have resistance to that, therefore, as I said, Buddhism will be popular by theory. By actual engagement, we will still be very few number of people. When the Pope comes, and there are hundreds and thousands of people who gather, a dhatan, for example, sitting still in meditation, I wonder if we will ever come to a point where a dhatan, where a Trungpa Rinpoche's tradition of a month-long sitting in silence and watching the nature of your own mind will ever have 100,000 people. Going by the books and how many books sell, and all the articles on how peace and loving kindness is so much needed in this chaotic and suffering world, that should be the top on the list of priorities, don't you think? But it won't be. It won't be because fact is, we would like changes to occur more externally rather than realize the responsibility of an internal change. So we never really effectively look at our own selves and our own mind as a subject of investigation, subject of transcendence, subject of work. Where that is the resistance, there will be a certain distant relationship with the view. You don't want it to go there too much. Because human beings are intelligent. From the Buddhist teachings perspective, primordial wisdom is intrinsic. And therefore, since the inner nature of one's own mind is vividly clear and clever and wakeful, innate nature itself being wakeful, it knows. And therefore, the resistance keeps a certain distance, which allows us in the interim period some time to still continue as we have been doing for so long. But then you have become a Buddhist, you know already too much not to address the pivotal issues either. Therefore, what do? Is you go to teachers. And you change teachers. You try out different lineages, different methods of practices. You read books and highlight certain passages that you will do when you retire. Beautiful, nice ways in which to keep up the excitement and the entertainment of spirituality, not fully, however, ready to truly look intrinsic within one's own self. When that happens, then that is getting into falling in love with the method more. Then you will love the methods of Dharma very much. And that's why people are very willing to go into retreats, follow teachers around, sit many hours, listen to many teachings. But the fact always has to be is, what are you going to do with them? What are you going to do with these things? If you're not going to apply it within one's own self. Application of the view must be clear and in accord with the teachings. So the very first work would be is hearing the teachings and being able to introduce yourself to what the Buddha taught. What was the original teachings of the Buddha? Teachings itself simply is the presentation of the view. And therefore the introduction to the very fundamental of the view of Dharma. And what does this mean is, fundamental view of the Dharma means the answer to the question, what does a Buddhist do? I've been mulling over this question that I've been sort of working with. Normally when people, we live our life answering people's questions, so it's not so difficult to come up with an answer. But when I left India this time, I got stopped by the immigration officer in New Delhi airport. And normally it happens because we are dressed in robes, and so people always try to start a philosophical sort of a discussion. And so the immigration officer asked me, what is the qualification needed for you to become a Buddhist? I almost always have an answer, but it took me a while because in one I thought, what qualification is needed actually to become a Buddhist? There's no qualification. Anyone can become a Buddhist. But before I could come up with an answer, he said, oh, I guess it is kindness. That if there is kindness in the mind, then you can become, that's enough qualification for a Buddhist, isn't it? So I said, yes, yes, that's true. That's the right answer. And it's been about a month since that question was put to me. But it's been on my mind. Is that really true? Is kindness really the qualification, all that is needed to be a Buddhist? Second question before I left, and he stamped my passport. He said, what does a Buddhist do? And that is then being put to a nun. I should know what I do from morning to night, isn't it? But I don't know exactly what I said, but I said, I think we said something like study and practice and meditate or something like that. But what do I do? What do I do? So what do the Buddhists do? Many of you are Buddhists. If I asked you a question, how many are Buddhists? Many of you would raise your hands. And if that question, what does a Buddhist do? Help me out here. What does a Buddhist do? What are we supposed to be doing, laden by all these teachings and teachers and methods and practices, if it is not to really hone and refine that quality inherent of every human being, the capacity to be good, the capacity to stay out of trouble, causes that bring suffering, confusion to oneself and the others, to be able to use whatever capacity you have to create harmony and peace in yourself and around yourself. Doesn't sound spectacular or extraordinarily difficult. Definitely doesn't ring bells. It's not like a big explosion. And do we bargain for that? Many of us actually didn't become a Buddhist to hear that either. We became Buddhist to become enlightened, to one day win the race, turn back with our nursing kit, come back to the beings, the foolish ones who've been left behind, and tell them how good we are, how more knowledgeable we are, to be able to have free access to every trouble and not be held responsible for that. Sometimes that's our idea of what enlightenment is. It's the gloating and the expansion and the exaggeration and the bigness of the ego and the right to display it with titles such as holinesses and bodhisattvas. So when we live in that kind of an imagination of this is what it is, what is spirituality, that's where ego steps in. And what could be a perfect path generating genuineness, genuine goodness, the truer potential of a human being, simply becomes caught up in the ego's manipulation, and that then becomes what Trungpa coined this term, spiritual materialism. That's what spiritual materialism is. Wherever there is tremendous amount of appearance of meditation, spirituality, knowledge, philosophy, but it never really touches the core of the mind of the person powerfully enough to actually bring about a change. Here again, not a change that you think you brought in, but a change evident to the others who relate to you every day. Then, where that change is not seen, where the attitude and the conduct doesn't have the evidence of that change, then you are the one promoting spiritual materialism all the time. And in order to be able to not fall into that gap, that loophole of spirituality, foremost exertion and concentration must be given in spending time with this unappetizing thing called learning the view, as the Buddha taught. Fundamental pillars of Dharma, Buddhism, grows on the presentation of the view, anitya, anatman, dukkha. Things are transient in nature, constantly moving, constantly changing, temporary, impermanent. Tremendous participation and extensive, limitless capacity of compositeness, of coming together, of causes and conditions. Being struck by the marvels of interdependent, codependent energies and powers that are in constant influx, constant change, constant movement, and yet have magnificent displays. But in that magnificent display, every component is an important component. No one factor can be credited to being more important or less important. But that there is the need for the view of a human being who has the capacity to see this, to examine this, to be able to see this, to be able to examine it. You know, sometimes artists, painters, for example, have this gift of looking at a canvas and being able to speak a volume on what they see. Then there are people who have no understanding of art, who may walk by the thing, glance, and say something like, I don't know, I don't like it, or I like it, and walk by. Perspective is like that. And the Buddha's view, presenting of the first view of anitya, of impermanence, but also impermanence being simultaneous or synonymous for also speaking about interdependency, constant change, constant coming together, manifesting, constant dissolution phase. Speaks also of that view that needs to be developed in the mind of a meditator who takes time, physically stops, verbally quietens down, mentally concentrates in being able to have a larger, vaster, kinder perspective to things. And so when we talk about cultivating the first view of Buddhist teachings, the view of emptiness, a view of impermanence, we are not talking about, oh, looking at seasons changing. There are lots of teachings that teach impermanence in different ways. And because of our hurried ways of approaching the subject, very often we think, oh, impermanence is a bad news. So everything is changing. Yes, everything is changing. But that's not what is being talked about within the view of impermanence. Impermanence view is the most kindest approach of being able to see the coming together of all different factors that go into building up of a situation. After all, when people say things like, I'm learning to meditate to become a kinder person, what does it mean? And yes, there are various different methods. You think of a person suffering in front of you, then you breathe out nice light and that person's negativities are all washed away like black smoke, and then you breathe out nice white light, and then that sort of invigorates the person. All very nice methods. And when, if I am teaching on that, then probably I'll say something else. But this is not the point here that I'm trying to make. This is all very good. It's all very nice. But that's very basic kindness. It's a primary level of a kindness. Referential, very, very much all about you and your feelings. It's very indulgent to your emotions. Genuine kindness would be coming to a certain point where you cannot see anything better or less, more important or less important, more beautiful or not, because you lose the concept of it since you see the multitude of various factors that go into the buildup of a situation. Let me say that with an example. Few years ago, in my travels through the world in different Buddhist centers, you get thanked after every seminar or teaching. People are always very gracious and they will say things like, Natalie started off, which I cut her off today. At the end there's always a thank you. And people are very kind when they thank the teacher and wonderful things are said about the person and so forth. And oftentimes I think, more than the teacher, there are so many other people who need to be thanked also, which is very, very important. Because there are some people, and then in some cases, some people get thanked. But there's always a hierarchy that we get into. Visible ones are thanked, or those with ranks are thanked even better, and so on and so forth. So I always felt, many people were being left behind, and felt very uncomfortable, and for many years. Then, some 10 years ago, I started this tradition of saying thank you properly. Down in Virginia, where there is Lotus Garden, then we started with every seminar or every retreat ending with a genuine list, trying to come up with everyone on the list who has helped, down to doing small things like washing spoons or putting plates back, just thanking everybody. First day first attempt was quite nice. It was quite good. Everybody liked, everybody thought it was very kindly meant and everybody was appreciative of it. Following the same tradition a few more times, then we had to do away with the last session's teaching because that much amount of time was being needed to read out all the names and then describe what they were doing to be thanked. And then people got fidgety. They got a little bit irritated about this. Why is this? We didn't pay to come and hear the thank you address. Those who got thanked felt very embarrassed about it. So it got into all sort of difficulties. And the worst was, no matter how well the list was made, there was always someone left out. So then now, after 10 years of doing that, we've gotten down to just saying, thank you everyone. Everyone who helped, thank you very much. So, example here I'm using at how we cannot actually be so careful as to not do something or create a cause of some discrimination until the mind expands to being free from discrimination from its root. The subject or the view presented in Buddhist teachings, anitya and anatman, both Sanskrit terms. Anitya is a Sanskrit term for impermanence. Anatman literally can be translated as no self, absence of self, which is often today, as many of you are familiar with, integrated into the subject of emptiness, nature of phenomena and self, so brilliantly taught in Buddhist teachings, and many of you have studied that. But both of these two concepts, concept that things are always impermanent, with this great subtle energy of causes and conditions coming together, despite the inherent emptiness and the influx changes that are occurring, there's always a beautiful manifestation. Teaching the mind to developing a view of seeing the wholeness of everything rather than a part of the whole. An example is seeing the painting as a whole rather than sort of going just by the signature of the painter. Some people buy paintings for the signature. That's what ups the price. Whereas those must be great artists whose signatures are there, but sometimes their painting is terrible. Or at least a Tibetan mind thinks so. I have no understanding of modern art, for example. But then, on the other hand, someone who would truly appreciate the art wouldn't mind the signature, would go by everything, the wholesomeness of what the canvas holds. View of a meditator must be like that. Thinking about emptiness, nature works the same way. Emptiness is not about non-existence of certain things, which is misunderstood by many people. Subject of emptiness is more going by what lies behind the cause and effect, what lies behind the impermanence. If everything is impermanent, brought into manifestation by moving components of causes and conditions, then what is the underlying basis upon which they all meet? Is there a basis that is findable? Can we actually locate some structure, some platform that is unmoving, that is permanent, visible, and something that can be held? Now, why that is needed, why is it important to understand that, is all about giving credit. Whom do we credit for appearance? Whom do we credit for sound? Whom do we credit for the articulation of all our feelings and emotions and sensations? Because at some point, suffering, the third truth presented in the view of Dharma, is taught by the Buddha as the result of not knowing the nature. Suffering is unintentional, most often times, but born out of ignorance. What kind of an ignorance is? The ignorance of bias, ignorance of discrimination. This is pretty, this is not pretty. I like this, I do not like this. Easy to say, judgments easy to give, effects of it terrible for those who are on the receiving end of it. And so the origin of every apprehension, origin of every blame, origin of pain, guilt, suffering, uncomfortableness, origin of there being a beautiful day and you being miserable, is the result of discrimination, result of biases, result of opinions, build up of all of these discriminations that have been projected from the minds of self and others. So therefore, when the Buddha taught, he taught about suffering being there, but there being a cause, and the need to examining the cause becoming the path of cessation. So what we call nirvana in English, literally sort of people these days always say enlightenment, which is, I do not know what the English term enlightenment would actually mean or be sufficient, because the term nirvana actually has much more a deeper connotation of freedom from something that is tainted, or whatever is pure after the removal of whatever is false, which then, in some of the philosophical terminology, the term truth, as it is used, especially in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Recognizing the nature as is, or what is often also called Buddha nature, or suchness. These terms are used to indicating what the Buddha in his first teaching referred to as uprooting the cause, is the cessation that can arise from engaging on the path of the Dharma. Which means, if we are calling ourselves Buddhists, embarking on the journey, establishing a practice called the Buddhist practices, by virtue of referring to ourselves as Buddhists, what does a Buddhist do? Then the answer would be is, I'm trying to bring cessation to the cause of suffering. That's the right answer. I don't think an immigration officer would be very impressed with that, but for us, those who are practicing, that's what should be in our mind, is that each day that what we are doing is we are trying to bring cessation to the causes of suffering, and which then requires not only hoping for the cessation, But then doing truly bringing about a deepened investigation into what causes the rampantness, unceasing evolution of those causes. Where is it coming from? Can it be conveniently simply be called, oh, many causes, outside, inside, you and my others, all to be blamed? Would that be a sufficient answer? If going deeper beyond what is a convenient answer, where does suffering and the cause of suffering, which is bias, discrimination, judgments, opinions of a mind that is said to be ignorant of reality, ignorant of not knowing the true nature, then, as the Buddha said, this is the view I present. Whether it is true or not depends entirely upon your investigation. You should not take my word for it. That being his first instructions, direct instructions, therefore, those of us who are on the path of the practice must say, is it really true? If for nothing else, if you can prove the Buddha wrong, your life will be much more easier. Then we can always say, I'm not kind because of you. I'm trying to be patient, but no one will listen. I have very pure intentions, but no one understands me. But we can validate those excuses that we retain in our habits. But if it is to be proven to be correct, then the investigation must be done. And so the view requires you to then say, what is the basis upon which biases seem to come? Then the answer that must be cultivated through one's own analysis and investigation is busyness, just the quickness and the hurriedness. The greatest characteristics of not being able to know the true nature of things as they are is just that we do not take time to consider things more fully. It's so much easier to give very quick, decisive answers of yes and no, likes and dislikes, good and bad, pure and impure, rather than to have the time to sit down and look at the wholesomeness of all causes and conditions and components that come together. We just won't be able to have a conversation. If our mind were constantly aware of the interdependent origination of appearances, if our minds were constantly aware of the view of impermanent nature of everything, the beauty of all appearances that are in constant influx, our coffee table conversations will be very difficult. It would be like all atoms and molecules and cells and different causes and conditions, all the elements and different energies and the different karma of all the sentient beings are manifesting as a certain moment which has moved away. That's going to be the kind of direction our conversation is going to have to be all the time. And it's not entertaining. And for that, if we look at it in that way, we find the habits and the impulses, which are so used to being driven by apparentness, having no time to think deeper of all different factors that come into being. So then, when in this hurried way, the sort of decisions are made, in a hurried way, opinions are based, in a hurried way, so all of the different kinds of praise and blame, credits and discredits have been given, the momentum builds up an attitude of ignorance, of not knowing completely, going by what is very visually apparent, going by very much what is apparent to the sound. And together with that comes in the agenda of what does it do to you or doesn't do to you. A very strong promoting fact of if it does good to you, it must be good. If it doesn't do anything good to you, then it is to be not cared about. So the result of that is heart and mind of the person begins to become more and more rigid. So the chaos, the busyness, the lacking in time for consideration of many different factors, the build-up of a quick discriminating tendency, biased attitude, simply results in the form of a hardened heart, where the deciding criteria for everything that we think and judge is based upon your own gain and not your loss. And then where the entire civilization and social communities, human world, live in a culture of this momentum, then it becomes necessary for you to follow a teacher from the Himalayas, sit in an evening like this, think of a dying person in front of you, visualize a silly syllable that you have trouble visualizing, thinking of lights coming out, going into the heart of the other person, smoke and black things coming out, then you're feeling all light and nice. Very childish approach to telling you you can be kind. It's a lot of beating around the bush, as you say in English, to get to the point. Why would otherwise great kind bodhisattvas ever want you to sit in that uncomfortable way, as some of you have been bravely been able to do so? Those of you on the chairs have either not experimented with it or are reluctant to do so or have given up. Isn't it? But those of us who said, why is it important? Why is it important to learn liturgies? Why is it important to visualize deities with four arms, six heads? Why is it important to go into retreats, lock yourself up in rooms? Why is it important for any of these methods? It's to make you sit still, keep you quiet, and to stop having so many opinions. That's all there is to it. But you have to sugarcoat it like most capsules. You know, you have to coat it with a certain theme called spirituality. And you have to say things like, 2500 years ago, under a tree, there was a golden-bodied Buddha who sat, attained enlightenment after 6 years of hard penance and told you there is suffering. You are creating it all the time because you are too busy to even consider many factors that go into building up of different situations. If that's not suffering, what is? If that's not ignorance, what is? And so, view needs to be able to think of your path of practice in this way. This is what a Buddhist does. This is the view that must be held within the minds of every meditator, every practitioner. Is that when I do have the capacity to think of everyone, why won't I do so? Why is it so easy for me to simply be seduced by habitual impulses, despite simultaneously knowing that that impulse and responding to that impulse is just habit? Whether it's a habit of anger, whether it is a habit of jealousy, whether it is a habit of selfishness, irritation, arrogance, whatever it may be. We all do. There's no one who hasn't studied some amount of Dharma who hasn't heard that these five root poisons, desire, anger, ignorance, jealousy, arrogance, must be uprooted. Do we do it? And that question, and holding that question in one's own mind, and see, why do we let these negativities, what are called neuroses, what are called defilements, what are called poisons, there couldn't be worse terms for it. The term itself suggests there's no place for these within our own minds. Shouldn't be. There shouldn't be a place for these. But nevertheless, the impulse that draws us into the habitual sort of ways of clinging to these root poisons. It's happening in one's own self. Meditation, cultivation of Dharma in your life is to be able to watch for that. Why does it happen? Why is it so easy to be magnetized, to be propelled into responding to these five poisons? And so, that then makes one look more deeper within one's own self. And we find that yes, it's just the absolute lack of making space for a bigger perspective to be understood. So there's actually no other way but to sit in this posture, to sit quietly. And if the mind and the verbal speech are so used to being constantly seduced by habitual patterns, then taking on a much more skillful way of making you recite something. Each mantra given to you a million times to recite technically means a million moments of quietness, which would otherwise be spent in generating discriminating thoughts. A million moments sat in a traditional way is keeping yourself physically still. A million moments away from otherwise using your body, simply responding to the same impulses of habitual patterns. Mind, through the reference, no matter how awkward it may be, balancing a four-headed deity on six legs. But it is definitely a thousandfold less complicated than the other neurotic thoughts that would cross your mind. So skillful ways in which part of the practice is there. As I said earlier, sadly, people fall in love with the deity, the mantras, and the sitting, and the view is again lost. The manipulation of the ego can never be underestimated. It's not going to give up that easily. So the same habitual patterns will try to manipulate methods of the practices into being most important. And whenever you make the method more important than the view, that has to be kept ever constant in your awareness, then you have become a wonderful religious person, but not necessarily a Buddhist. For a Buddhist, doesn't matter what you are doing, how you are doing. In those moments where you are able to have a format of a practice, and a moment to do what we call formal meditation. It's all very nice. Gaining familiarity with stillness and silence is always the greatest resource for the wisdom mind to have a much more pervasive perspective of things that you encounter in your daily life. But one individual sitting in meditation is not Buddhist practice. It is through the platform of that formal meditation that when you walk out the door in that post-meditation situation, how much of what you have gained as an insight are you then able to permeate and carry in your attitude, in your conduct? And at that moment, does that individual meditator or a person look at the world with a different perspective? A perspective that understands things come into origin. Things build and are contributed by many different factors. And in that manyness and the beauty of all the contributing factors, your relationship to what evolves becomes a much more gentler relationship. Mind becomes a little bit more able to have a vaster perspective to things. Where crediting one or the other is not the issue, but a sense of gentle acceptance of manyness comes into being. Emptiness is nothing other than this. Emptiness is not having given yourself a convenient, positable point upon which you can give more priority to your own likes and dislikes. That's knowing emptiness, emptiness of the ego. Being able to see the beauty and the contribution of many causes and conditions into build-up of anything, perfection and imperfections, is having a healthier relationship with things as they are, without positing the ego's likes and dislikes over it. That's compassion. So in the Mahayana teachings, the two main qualities that are taught to meditators to cultivate, seeing the emptiness and cultivating compassion, are simply built into this one single attitude that we've been talking about. Flexible attitude that has a vaster perspective to things, steps back a little bit to not see things based on how you want it or what is convenient to you, but based upon being able to see everything as it evolves, as it manifests. Then in that heart, in that mind, which accepts the change, which accepts the transition, which accepts the interdependency of many different factors, which accepts that since everything is in constant change, constant manifestation, there is really no place for the self to assert its opinions and decisions, thereby the emptiness, nature of the assertion of the self. Such a mind then would be an altruistic mind. What is altruism? What is selflessness? Considered for Buddhists the very epitome of the quality of compassion, selflessness. What does that mean? It's the non-assertion of the non-importance of one's own biases and prejudices. But that's not going to happen automatic by simply saying, oh, I need to be selfless, I need to overcome my selflessness. That becomes an ambitious project to become selfless. It's about correcting the view. It's about correcting the view with which you see the world, correcting the perspective with which you relate to situations, so that the uptightness and the rigidity that is often brought in our attitude and in our conduct towards others, so has a possibility to disintegrate. Unkindness is simply the unwillingness to be flexible, to be understanding, to be able to develop a malleable attitude in situations. But if the mind were to understand the view of impermanence, if the mind were to understand the baselessness, the rootlessness of the assertion of the self and the self's dualistic ideas, opinions, judgments, then such a mind would be able to accommodate better things as they are. If it happens, fine. If it doesn't happen, fine. We're not talking about not having an opinion at all. By all means, as long as you have senses, you'll always have opinions and feelings. But it's not a big deal any longer. Because you do know that at a certain moment, you cannot not be grateful for whatever is arising in front of you. Adverse moments, even as they arise, feeling-wise, as far as your own sensation and experiences go, it may be adverse, but how can you not acknowledge the fact that it is also the build-up of many causes and conditions as they are? And that is, what you are seeing, reality and the nature of which is emptiness, which is impermanence, which is in constant movement. But then more than that, then the Mahayana teachings say, there's a deeper mind that relates to that. And so if things are always impermanent, things are always constantly moving, evolving, manifesting, and disintegrating, then of course, since that is always a reality, a change that is occurring, how does your mind relate to that? If the mind in relating to that opposes what is the natural flow, then there is difficulty, that suffering. But if it realizes, as a meditator, it begins to also see that the relationship, the perspective of how things are, being your own, if you're able to relax within that a little bit, things go your way, things do not go your way, both are actually under your control. How you respond to that is very much your choice. Therefore, if you would become more aware, instead of changing the other, if you were to become more aware of mind's relationship to the appearances, to the sound, to the thoughts, then you truly realize how powerful you are. So when we talk about liberation, this is what we're talking about, is that you become empowered within your own self, liberated from other references to choose your own. And so it is an absolute sense of responsibility, but also an absolute power that the individual recognizes within one's own self. Simply put, you become the designer of your own experience. And therefore, that what is moving around you depends how you look at it. If the exaggeration of whatever it is that you are generating externally, your relationship to the other, retains the agenda of an arrogant, uncompromising assertion of the ego, then it's always going to contradict. It's going to try and still things. That's where we don't want change, although change is always there. That's where we want to pick and choose, whereas you can't pick and choose. There's all different factors that go into the contribution of one. So when we say things like, "You used to be better before I married you," in that one little sentence, we pick and choose things that we like, and then we don't want to deal with the rest. And of course, when you become very rigid without taking the sort of overall situation or all of the factors into consideration, then that creates the momentum of aggression. And that's where everything that is abrasive, everything that is uncomfortable, everything that is separation begins to take shape. So therefore, in the Buddhist teachings, through all the, especially in the Mahayana teachings, the view, the cultivation of the view of seeing things as they move through meditation, learn impermanence. Through meditation, see the baselessness, the rootlessness of the assertion of the ego. See how suffering is created when this is not understood. And then take all of these three into seeing the relationship between, therefore, mind and what appears as appearance, mind and what appears as sound, mind and what appears as thoughts. Appearances, if they are allowed to be appearances by the mind. There's a lot of harmony that evolves from that. If the mind allows sound to be sound, then there's a lot of harmony. If mind allows gamut of experiences, feelings and sensations, thoughts, to be simply that, then it's really not much to do at all. Everything is okay. But when it doesn't do that, appearances, and you begin to immediately index them in different compartments, sounds, and you begin to bring discrimination to that, thoughts, and you begin to immediately sift through which are mine and which are yours, and good and bad and painful and good memories and so on and so forth, then that is, as I said, a habit, an impulse, creating duality and discrimination, cause of suffering, born out of simply a very linear outlook to things that doesn't take into consideration nature of emptiness and that there being no place for the ego to assert itself in every situation. So this then being what the Buddha first mentioned in his first teachings, often called the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, presenting what are known as the Four Noble Truths, but in the context of the Four Noble Truths, the three fundamental views. There is suffering arising out of a cause of ignorance, of not knowing the nature of impermanence, and no self. Now, if that is then the view, and you are in a line at the airport, and an immigration officer asks you, "What's your religion?" And you say, "You're a Buddhist." "What does a Buddhist do?" This is what you have to explain. So I'll stop here for this evening, here, and continue with what is... Then, since this is the view, then how can we take that view into integrating into engaged attitude as a Mahayana practitioner? I think that's the next segment. Thank you all very, very much. And of course, I don't know, I'm sure with the four of the wonderful teachers who are guiding the Westchester study group, the Buddhist group, as well as many of you who are from, who are also teaching, who are from other very good Dharma groups, all have a wonderful opportunity to practice the Dharma and therefore deepen your understanding and know the subject, a very important subject for all human beings, what we temporarily refer to as Buddhist teachings. But at the same time, if there are questions or things that can be discussed that might be helpful, never hesitate to ask that. So, I won't say tonight, because normally whenever I say, do you have a question, I wait for about 5 seconds before someone raises the hand. My sister, always my critic, tells me 5 seconds is always too little a time. You don't give them enough time. Yeah. But listening to her, sometimes I've waited for a little bit longer. People are often hesitant. So I go by most questions have been answered. Then I get notes from people afterwards, which then people tell me is because sometimes you don't want to speak, but feel comfortable writing. So whether it is speaking, whether it is writing, do feel comfortable in asking questions. If there are any, I'll be very happy to take them tomorrow. And let me tell you one thing. Even I grew up with this idea, is that all questions have to be smart. Now, if all questions were smart, what are we supposed to be doing here? Then you wouldn't have to be here, remember that. So it doesn't matter how the question sounds. As long as it's a question that needs to be answered or some discussions can be made, it's always very nice to always speak about it. This tradition that we call Buddhist teachings today has taken the shape of speaker and listeners. And this is a very new concept. Dharma can never be practiced this way. This is not the way to actually approach teachings. Teachings are always based upon question and answers. Do the practice, encounter the challenges, or find insights, meet with experiences, then discuss that, and then go further. And that's the way the progress of the path takes place. If you simply listen to a person and nod your head here and there, that's an evening spent very nicely. Probably has some benefit to it, but it doesn't really go the way it should go. So as much as possible, when you do have this study group here, the Buddhist group that is here, Westchester Buddhist group, I hope will provide what I think is most needed in the future of Western Buddhism, and that is a comfortable environment in which Dharma is not only given as a lecture, but that it is shared. It is something that people feel comfortable in approaching and work on it as their own individual path of the practice, guided, of course, with these wonderful teachers here, to whom I'm always very, very thankful. So, thank you all very much. Good night.